The women asked me if everything they had heard about the crematoriums was true. What was the smoke you saw pouring from the chimneys during the day, and the flames that replaced it at night? I tried to reassure them, denying everything. "It's not true," I repeated after each of their questions and surmises. "Besides, the war is almost over, and soon we'll all be back home." I said it without really believing it myself. I left them without having learned any news of my wife and daughter. I entered the first barracks and asked the overseer, a young Slovakian girl, to have the names of my wife and daughter called out. There were between 800 and 1,000 women stacked one above the other on the berths that lined the walls of every barracks. To have the names called out here was not easy. The noise of the 1,000 women drowned the single voice. The overseer returned a few minutes later to tell me that her search had proved fruitless. I thanked her for her kindness and entered the second barracks. Here the situation was much the same. The same scene was repeated with like results. I was in the third barracks, standing in the middle of the room. Again, I was in the third barracks, standing in the middle of the room. Again, I had the overseer called and asked her to have my wife and daughter sent for. She sent two little girls down each side of the barracks. They stopped at each layer of bunks and called out the names. In a few minutes, they returned, bringing my wife and daughter with them. They approached hand in hand, their eyes wide with fear, knowing the probable consequences of a personal summons. But they'd already recognized me. They stopped dead, astonished, rooted to the spot. I approached them, took both of them in my arms, and embraced them. They were incapable of speaking, but were satisfied to cry softly. I tried to console them, to reassure them. But already the crowd surrounded us. Under such conditions, there was absolutely no way of holding a conversation. I asked the overseer if she would let us have the use of her little room for a few minutes. Then, at last, we were alone. They brought me up to date on their sad experiences of the previous 3 months, the dreaded selections from which they had till now escaped, but the very thought of which made them tremble with fear, living as they did in the shadow of the crematorium chimneys. Dressed in rags, they suffered from cold and perpetual hunger. It rained in their barracks, and their clothes never dried out completely. The food was uneatable, and what was worse, they were unable to sleep. The place assigned to them was meant to hold 7 people. 12 were stacked in there. Women whose social rank back home was fairly high pushed and shoved each other in order to give themselves a few inches more space, thus hoping to sleep a little better, even if it was at the expense of their companions. Everybody here had lost her former personality. Friends or strangers, each was concerned only about her own well-being, unwilling to make the slightest concession. My daughter told me that she slept on the concrete floor since nobody would make a place for her on the bunk where her mother slept. My wife asked me about my work. I explained to her that I was Dr. Mengele's assistant and as such a member of the Sonderkommando. After 3 months of Katzet life, they too had learned that the Sonder was the commando of the living dead. Both looked at me aghast. I reassured them as best I could and promised to return the following day.